What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care. So sit back, relax, and defocus.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of the Defocus Media Podcast. This time we have, for all you opto nerds out there that like to follow along with the podcast, this is the podcast for you. We're going over the biggest studies of last year and the first of this year and how they can influence your practice. And we're here with our kind of favorite opto nerd guest, Dr. Jackie Garlich. You may recognize her from 2020 Glance. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Very well. And let's just start by getting to know you, Dr. Garlich. Tell us a little bit about yourself and 2020 Glance.
So I practice in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I am in a group practice. So it's an OD-MD group, and I'm the only OD in that group, and it's been great. That's a great practice to be a part of. And I started doing 2020 Glance because I never felt like I was up to date with like what was happening in optometry. I would go to like my continuing education and get all of that, but I always kind of felt like an idiot if I had a patient say like, oh, did you see in the news about this or that? And I was always like, nope, I definitely didn't see that, or I don't have time or whatever. So I started asking my friends and colleagues. I was like, how do you guys stay up to date? Maybe I missed something, you know, out there that is an easy way to do that. And everyone would just say, we don't, like, we don't stay up to date. We don't have time or whatever the case. So that's how I ended up starting 2020 Glance. So here it is.
What really is like the perfect combination of technical information, new studies coming out, but also pop culture. So like Kanye West gets the eye exam. We'll all know about it because that's probably what our patients are going to ask us about. So
I mean, I try to include the like what your patient might ask you. And even if it's kind of ridiculous and we know that this isn't a legit thing, but patients will see this and say, hey, did you see this in the news, or this person is doing this, or there's these, you know, just like something, I don't know, something they might ask you. I try to like include that in the newsletter. So at least you're like, yeah, I saw that. Definitely. This is what it is. And it's not legit or whatever the thing is.
Now, I know 2020 Glance is geared towards optometrists or eye care professionals, but being that it's growing so rapidly, have you had any patients that have actually come across your information online and came in and had dialogue with you at all?
I haven't had any patients read it, but I have had patients say, did you see something? And I did see it, like, and I did write about it. And so I'm like, oh, this is paying off. Excellent. Like, this actually is working. So, but no one that I know patient-wise has read it yet. Or they haven't told me, but I kind of like try to aim it more towards, you know, ODs, because I do include like studies and that sort of thing in there. So I don't know if like the average person that just likes eyes will enjoy it as much, but that would be cool if a patient saw it.
Daryl, I think you may be the only doctor that patients recognize from the internet. So this is like a specific Daryl phenomenon.
Yeah, no one recognizes me. So.
Well, you're definitely a celebrity in the optometry world. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, gosh, thanks.
Well, and you're also a pretty well-known speaker now. You do these segments for Intro Eyes. Do you enjoy recording those, or how that process been?
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Ryan and I, like, connected kind of a while back, and you know, he asked me to sort of participate on these videos for Intro Eyes and these, like, this trending section. And I was like, yeah, definitely. Like, I don't want to ever say no to anything. It just sounds really great and cool. But like, oh my gosh, you taking a video of yourself is like a whole nother level of self-consciousness. I mean, like, I was like, I have all this facial asymmetry that I was not aware of until I started doing these videos. And like, it's just, it's fun, but it's like, oh my gosh, this is, you're like way more critical, I think, on yourself, but it's been fun, and it gets easier the more I do it. But, so yeah, that's pretty cool that he's kind of working on that, like another little optometry startup.
That's the best thing about podcasting, right? We don't have to worry about like, it's sweatpants. It's great.
I know. Like, I'm for this podcast, I was like, great. I don't even have to shower. I mean, I can just talk.
Yeah, just all natural optometry right now.
So how long does it take for you to put together all this material? I mean, do you have a certain day where you sit down and read everything, or is it just all throughout the week?
I do it throughout the week. Otherwise, I spend a ton of time on the weekend doing it. So I try to like keep up with stuff during the week, which just tends to make it easier to sort of like put everything together when I do it like Sunday. So I get alerts, and then I'll just see something in the news, or people will send me information, which is always helpful. So I kind of try to keep on it during the week to lessen the burden on Sunday when I put it together.
That's pretty sweet that you have people send you information. What's the best way folks can actually send you some interesting articles? What's the best contact?
Oh, yeah. So you can email me at my personal email, Jacqueline Garlic, JacqueLynGarlich at Gmail, or 2020glance@gmail.com is another one that you can send it to. So yeah, I totally appreciate any of that stuff, just in case I didn't missed it in the news or whatever. It's very helpful.
We have a very aggressive schedule for your podcast today. We need to delve in to the biggest stories of the year as far as technical studies go in optometry. And the first one up, this is the study that I really cared most about this year. Corneal cross-linking got approved in April of 2016. And if you guys do keratoconus fits or have a lot of patients with keratoconus in your practice, which some studies say maybe 1 in 500 patients, so it's out there, it's actually pretty common. Corneal cross-linking has really kind of changed the game here. So this study that you reported on 2020 Glance was a 4-year follow-up study looking at 4 years of patients, average age around 22, 40 patients that who had cross-linking for progressive keratoconus. And the great thing about the study is they found that things were stable. There really was no progression in their uncorrected and corrected vision at that 1 year, 2 year, 4 year mark, and they really didn't have any bad side effects from the procedure. Only 5% of the patients they studied experienced treatment failure or progression in those 4 years. Dr. Garlich, have you had a lot of patients get cross-linking in your practice?
I so far have only had two actually, and one was a patient that I was co-managing with our cornea specialist, and he sent her to Canada. This is before it was FDA approved here. He sent her to Canada for cross-linking, and she's done really well. It's probably been 3 years now, I think, that she went up there, and she's very stable. Her vision remains the same, and her topography is stable, so that's certainly good. And then I recently just sent a patient who was 22 to Chicago for cross-linking, and that was probably a month or two ago, and so I'm just about to see her back for her contact lens fit. So I haven't had, you know, a lot, but the feedback, you know, from this 22-year-old that I just sent there, the thing she mostly talked about was that it was painful, like for the first hour or so after the procedure, but then she said, yeah, it's been good, and going okay, so time will tell with her, but this study is certainly promising that there is so much, you know, 95% of these patients were stable at that 4-year mark, so it's really promising and like a huge new option, treatment option for us for patients with keratoconus, which is great.
What I think is so exciting, I've had quite a few patients do it, and some younger patients like 18, 19, 20, and I've had a few that can wear glasses now. We're really not seeing well in glasses at all, and now I can finally get them backup glasses, which has been incredible. And just knowing, like, they're 16, they're in your chair, things jumped crazy from last year, but you can stop it right there, and they don't ever have to get worse. This procedure was approved for as young as 14, so, I mean, it is great when you first start seeing those cones happening. Don't let them become train wrecks.
Right, exactly.
I think catching it early is very key with this procedure, but the real question is, how do you talk to your patients, the parents, for these younger folks in regards to a procedure of this magnitude? Because I'm pretty sure the cost of it is up there, and then also, I mean, it's a kid that you're actually having a pretty intense procedure performed to. I mean, anything's going to be intense if you think about it to a kid. How do you convey this information to the parents of the patients?
Yeah, Jen, I'm actually curious, since you've had several patients, what conversation you have.
Now that it's FDA approved, I know it's out-of-pocket expense. Insurance really isn't covering this, but it's not that hard, because when even a patient Googles or a patient's parent Googles keratoconus, I've had patients come in crying, like they're so concerned. They see corneal transplant, they see how aggressive this condition can get, and the promise of cross-linking, honestly, it gives them so much hope. So it's an easy conversation. Now, before it was FDA approved, I did have a parent really, really get mad at me. I sent them to a doctor to discuss corneal cross-linking. It was one of those situations where corneal cross-linking was gonna get approval any day now sort of thing, and we had a doctor who was talking about it and gearing patients up for it. And he called me back and he was like, how would you send my child to talk about this experimental procedure? And of course, like a month later, I got FDA approval. But anyway, he now is getting the treatment done. But it was a difficult conversation back then. Now, if I'm not talking about cross-linking, the patients already Googled it, already know about it by the time I do their specialty contact lens fit. So a lot of times I'm doing a fit and they're like, I'm going to get that cross-linking thing next year. And it's like, all right, $1,000 for your contact lenses today, that's not too bad if you think about what cross-linking is going to cost them for their whole future.
So which method of the cross-linking technology do you feel is going to be most promising? I mean, I know there's one where you actually do it with the epithelium on, which seems like it will reduce any type of infections that may take place. And then also there's the option of the epithelium off, which was seen pretty painful. But what are your thoughts? What have you ladies seen in the research in regards to that?
Yeah, they actually, the procedure, so the Avedro, is like the one that was FDA approved, and that one is approved for epi off, but there is, I think, one in the works for an epi on option. But yeah, there is like a big epi on versus, epi off kind of debate.
I'm sure if they did epi on, it wouldn't be nearly as painful. I mean, the discomfort is something people really talk about.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I was actually going to ask you guys is how often you're doing topography then on these keratoconus patients of yours now that, does that change how often you do it now that we have this FDA approval?
So I'm only seeing them after they be released from the ophthalmologist and ready to return to specialty contact lens fits. So I'll do a topo just, yearly when I start my specialty fit for these patients. But I think they're probably seeing the ophthalmologist back a little bit. They'll probably do like a 3-month and a 6-month follow-up there for them to get monitored. So this next study, Dr. Garlash, you actually had recently sent this one to me to look at. It was published just this month, January 2017, preeclampsia and the long-term risk of maternal retinal disorders. So what they're finding is women that had preeclampsia had a higher risk of retinal detachment, diabetic retinopathy, tractional retinal detachment especially was highly associated. And this is lifelong, not just while they're pregnant. And so it was kind of a really interesting and fascinating finding and may really influence how we talk to our patients that are pregnant during the exam.
Yeah, I mean, this study was this was a huge study. There's like over 1 million women that they sort of looked at this data, from, they just obtained all this information from this hospital data in Canada. But this is like from the years of like 1989 to 2013. So this is like no small, study here that they looked at. But this, do you ever, I read this study and I thought, do I ever ask my patients, women that have had children, hey, did you have preeclampsia 10 years ago when you had your kid? Like, I never ask that, but like, maybe we should be with this study. It's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, they're saying women that had this severe preeclampsia had 4 times the risk for a tractional detachment and retinal break, whereas women that had mild preeclampsia only had 2x the risk, but still significant, And so I was sort of like, why exactly is this happening to the retina? And this is all talking about after, postpartum. So there's a lot of studies that study women during pregnancy and preeclampsia and how that affects the eye. And that's all very known, but there's very little study on how women do, after they've already delivered. So the theory that these authors suggest is that the preeclampsia can like hypothetically weaken the retina during pregnancy, which increases the propensity for these small breaks that maybe go unnoticed or undetected, or that they even just develop postpartum. So it's sort of, it's an interesting study, and it's sort of, I think it may even change the way, we examine hypertensive patients yearly, diabetics yearly, and maybe we'll say, hey, patients that have preeclampsia, we should see you yearly as well.
I think, I've always kind of considered eyes at risk to be more of those chronic conditions, chronic hypertension, chronic diabetes, these short, you know, period windows, even if you have really extreme high blood pressure during that time, once everything's back to normal, I never really in my mind associated you with a greater risk. And so that's just kind of changing the mindset of how we really can think about vascular disease and its effects on the eyes. It doesn't have to be prolonged. Even just these tiny windows of time could really damage the eyes or put the eyes at risk forever. This is really kind of scary to our patients too, because they don't associate eye care with these momentary periods of like pre-diabetes or, you know, gestational diabetes. That's what I was trying to say. So they don't really associate these sort of conditions during pregnancy with any sort of long-term health risks, which is obviously not the case.
Yeah. You see, it's this type of research and studies that I think will set us apart as optometrists with, you know, online refractions or disruptive technology that's out there. If we actually sit down and take the time and educate our patients about these studies that we're seeing and bring them in maybe once or twice a year, I think it'll go a long way with them, because of course they're going to go home and Google it and they're going to see the research about that and they're going to trust us and they're going to say, hey, you know what, this would have never been found unless I came into that exam room. I would have never known about it unless I talked to Dr. So-and-so.
Daryl, you raise a really good point, because you know, some of these online refractive apps will have a questionnaire at the beginning and it'll ask you, do you have diabetes? And if you hit yes, then like, oh, can't use this app, you've got to see a doctor. But is it asking them, did you have preeclampsia? Absolutely not. There's so many health conditions that aren't diabetes that we're letting potentially patients at risk slip through the cracks. And I think it just goes to show how those sort of questionnaires aren't helpful in any way.
Absolutely.
The next series of studies that we're talking about in today's podcast all center around dry eye. And that is kind of the biggest thing, I think, of the year in optometry. A lot of dry eye research came out. We had Xiidra coming on the market as a new treatment for dry eye, and it's actually been pretty disruptive already. I think they'd had over 60,000 prescriptions written by the end of the year. So it's something that optometrists have really been embracing and using. The crazy thing to me about dry eye is we still don't fully understand it. So it's kind of like we're still trying to really define what dry eye is. And a lot of these studies are telling us a lot about it. So this first one up, published March 2016, says the impact and duration of contact lens wear on the structure and functions of meibomian glands. They were looking at 100 patients in several different groups, ones that wore contact lenses, ones that have never worn contact lenses, and ones that were previous wearers but had stopped at least 6 months ago. And what they found is from someone, the group that had never worn any contact lenses, whether you had were a current contact lens wearer or used to be a contact lens wearer and had been out of them at least 6 months, when you wear contact lenses, it's associated with a lot of damage to the meibomian glands, reduced expression, plugged glands, meibomian gland atrophy, debris on the Marks line, reduced T-butt scores. So contact lens wear is somehow influencing permanent meibomian gland morphology, and it's not just the contact lens, maybe it's causing more evaporation. There's something that's really happening to the glands because you had a contact lens in your eye. What are you guys, did that change how you were thinking about contact lenses at all?
I think this study is really interesting, and there was actually an article written in October this past year on review of contact lenses, sort of discussing this thing here. And I think the like leading theory as to why this all even happens, like the cause of that lid wiper staining, is that there's this friction between that area and then the ocular surface. And if that ocular surface isn't like properly lubricated, or there's dryness or there's debris on the contact lens, that then leads to this localized inflammation. And given the like proximity of the lid wiper area and the meibomian glands, it like makes total sense when you really start thinking about it. But it's sort of interesting. I think there's so much dryness even with contact lenses, and I think that's sort of driven a lot of the contact lens companies to sort of try to get a lens material that really mimics the ocular surface to try to, I guess, you know, eliminate some of these symptoms here.
I think it's really kind of changed the way I'm very lucky to be able to practice with meibomian gland imaging. So I have a LipiView in the office, and I have a lot of patients, we're getting imaged for the first time, and they have obvious gland atrophy. And they'll ask me, oh my gosh, did like my contact lenses cause this? And really up till I read this study, I was like, oh no, these glands are in your eyelid. The contact lens isn't rubbing on them in any way. But now I kind of have to rethink that. And like, secondarily, maybe there was an influence there because you were a contact lens wearer. Now your glands are really messed up permanently. I can never get those back. And is this something that maybe we have to think about when we're fitting a kid in contact lenses, telling mom, like, this contact lens could permanently lead your child to having more dry eye as an adult? Like, there's something that we might have to inform them about as a risk now.
And again, this opens up just great opportunity of, you know, potentially, hey, let's go to a daily contact lens instead of a monthly, you know, something that may be a little thinner. That way when they blink, it's not causing as much friction, you know, just educating the patient on this is why you want to come into the exam room so we can actually go over all this stuff, show you what's taking place, show the imaging, and just show the difference of why you need to fit the appropriate contact lens for each patient.
I think that's the point. Yeah, we got to see some studies that show dailies really help. The high, like the premium dailies, do they make a difference even versus older technology dailies? Because
I would say the older technology would be more ideal, right? The hydrogel, because it's thinner. I mean, the silicone hydrogel is a little thicker, so you're going to get more.
Yeah. So there's a ton of research that we've got to explore in this.
Yeah, it's a good point, and actually, like, almost a little scary because you think, how many times do you fit contact lenses? And yeah, I'm like you, Jenna. Up until this study, I was like, I would never have thought that, but then now I read this and I think, oh my gosh, I fit contacts all the time. Am I like causing this problem down the road? And then you're sort of, that can spiral into, I mean, I guess that sort of applies to everything, even this preeclampsia thing, like things that happen to your body, like are not always reversible. And that's same with retinal issues, macular edema. I tell patients, you know, if once the edema is gone, it's, you know, the architecture has been disrupted forever. And so, I mean, I guess that's sort of the case with even contacts now. It's kind of crazy, really.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff coming in the future that we'll have to keep an eye on that field, but it could really be a huge revolution in how we fit contact lenses and how we talk about contact lenses with our patients, for sure. This next one, talking about dry eye symptoms, which I guess you guys probably all feel the same with me. Nothing is more of a bane of my existence than dry eye symptoms. So this was a study actually out of the VA system, published December 2016. It's a longitudinal examination of the frequency of and risk factors for severe dry eye symptoms in U.S. veterans. So this study, because it's at the VA, we have a pretty specific group of patients that they're looking at. 120 patients age 64, obviously predominantly male, average age of 64. And what they were finding is patients with severe symptoms at baseline, a little under 75% of them don't get any better. They're still severe a year later, despite your treatment. So, and then patients with mild symptoms or asymptomatic dry eye, about half of them got more severe symptoms a year later, despite treatment. So it's kind of one of those frustrating things. The frustrating fight about dryness is it just keeps getting worse instead of better. And once you have a severe dry eye patient, they're probably never not going to be a severe dry eye patient. And the other kind of part of that is they looked at, well, what were some of the associated risk factors for that? And it has a lot to do with, unfortunately, how they feel about pain and their overall body health, too. So people that had more severe dry eye symptoms had more complaints of ocular pain. They had just more, in general, pain-like symptoms that they can complain to doctors about, more sleep disturbances, more mental health issues, depression, PTSD, and were on medications typically for those conditions like anti-anxiety medications. And we know a lot of those things can cause dry eye, those medications can, but their overall body symptoms seem to be related to their dry eye symptoms as well.
Yeah, that's, I mean, this study kind of highlights the fact that dry eye is not just ocular. I mean, there's many, it's multifactorial, and they actually did another study at the same VA in Miami, and they kind of, this was probably a year prior to that one, and they showed this link between dry eye and chronic pain disorders. And so they suggested in this study that really that there's maybe a central sensitivity disorder, which is when patients become more sensitive and get more pain with less provoking. So they'll become like hypersensitive to stimuli, like wind or light or something, and then they'll have this spontaneous pain feeling. So it's you know, I think it is multi. It's not just a dry eye ocular symptom, and it doesn't always start there. It can be other things that contribute to it.
Yeah, I mean, Jen and I, we had the opportunity to do a rotation at the VA together, and this study and the one that you just mentioned, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, seeing those patients in there, I mean, this is ideally exactly what I saw every single day. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Jen?
Yeah, but it is disheartening to me, because I can try to help the ocular surface. I can try to improve your tear breakup time and get rid of your staining, but can I make you feel good? That's a lot. And it's frustrating to patients. It's frustrating to me as their doctor that I can't make them better, even though everything looks better on the surface. But it tells us so much about what's going on inside the body, is not just what, you know, oh, you have this SPK. Once we fix that, you'll be fine. That's usually not what it is, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I think it's way past the VA system. And we see it. There's I've got a ton of 20, 30 year old patients in private practice that have chronic pain, and they have depression, and they have anxiety, and they have all these same kind of chronic overall pain issues that someone in the VA hospital setting might have. Just the anxiety and stress and difficulties of life can have the effects of people in the suburbs, like it does, unfortunately, someone who served in the military.
Yeah,
one of the key things that I think also is the ability to follow up. You know, in a private practice, you can see these patients more frequently, talk to them more, whether it's eye-related or some other systemic condition, and, you know, get them in the right place. And the VA, you know, they come in, and that follow-up system is just, you know, they can get lost in it, or it's, you know, 6 months down the road when you really need to see them in a month or so, you know?
That's true. And maybe there would be greater success on symptoms if you could do, because sometimes I think about my dry eye follow-ups. There's not a whole lot necessarily that I'm changing or doing at them, but it's more like a cheerleader pep talk, like, oh, the surface looks so great. I know it still feels bad, but you're doing amazing. Like, keep doing the good work. And I'll just, but at the VA system, yeah, you can't do cheerleader talks. Like, there's no way to bring your patients back in. You're lucky if you see them next year.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, cheerleader talk is huge when it comes to optometry, because, I mean, you need someone there to push you to treat the dry eye, treat the glaucoma, wear the glasses. I mean, if you don't have that person in your corner routinely, or if the patient doesn't have access to you like a private practice patient does, it's always going to be a problem. They're not going to, unfortunately, maybe not take the treatment as seriously as they potentially should.
I think this is another thing about like involving all like multiple providers. I mean, I think, I don't know, just talking with my patients, like so many things will come up that they're going through, or this or that. And really they maybe also need to be seeing, you know, their primary care more or whatever. And I think that the optometry can play a role into really sort of coordinating, but just communicating with these other providers, like, this is going on, they did mention this, blah, 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 and try to get more of a, you know, discipline sort of approach to even just treating dry eye as well as other things.
Right.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. I actually, whenever I'm in the States practicing in the Triangle area in North Carolina, I tend to refer a lot to Duke, simply because I know they have a system where they can access, you know, their primary care physician, their rheumatologist, their ophthalmologist, and, you know, it's good for them to be able to see all the different medications and get the complete pieces of the puzzle, rather than a patient come in and tell them, yes, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and they not really know what medications they're on. And those guys are good to the point where they refer everything back to me, and I'm able to see everything from all the doctors as well. So I strongly agree with what you're saying there, Jackie.
Definitely makes sense. I mean, there's only so much dry eye treatment that Restasis or Xiidra is going to be able to do if you've got a patient taking Allegra and Benadryl and Wellbutrin and Prozac. Like, it's it's going to be an uphill battle.
I mean, from medications to computer use to just everyday wear and tear, I mean, everyone's exposed to dry eyes. There's no doubt about it.
So speaking of that, this transitions great to the last study we want to hit on today. This was a study, Jackie, you covered great on 2020 Glance. I think it made a big buzz around the internet. Smartphone use as a risk factor for pediatric dry eye disease. So this study was published October 2016. It's coming out of Korea. They looked at just under 1,000 children with a diagnosis of dry eye, SPK, reduced TBUT, OSDI scores, that sort of stuff. And they found that the kids with dry eye had significantly more daily use of smartphones and kind of reduced outdoor activities, if you will, compared to the control group that didn't have dry eye. And so what these doctors did, I don't know how this would ever work in America, but they said no smartphones for 4 weeks, everybody in the dry eye group. And then 4 weeks later, they follow up and both the subjective symptoms and the objective dry eye symptoms and scores had statistical significant improvement. So kind of really pinpoints, stop the cell phones and wow, everything does get better. How do you talk about this with parents though?
Honestly, I feel like parents are asking me how many hours should they be on their phone, or they're asking me to back them up. Like they'll kind of like prompt the question, like, you know, this kid really is on his phone a lot or his computer a lot, hint, 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 tell them he shouldn't be or something. You know, I feel like they want, you know, them to hear it from the doctor that you should really not be doing it. But what I'm finding is that this is a really hard thing to say, don't be on the computer, because I think almost all of the kids I have use either Chromebooks or iPads in school. So, you know, there's no real textbook now. They all have smart boards that they're looking at. Then they look at their Chromebook or whatever, and then they go home and they have homework on their Chromebook, and then maybe they want to unwind, so they'll watch or play a game or something. I mean, it's, if you really probably add up the number of hours they're doing it, it's not like it's all for fun, you know, like they're doing schoolwork and that sort of thing on the computer too. So it's hard to say, like, you know, stop this, only this many of hours on the screen. I think it's like a hard thing to sort of assess or even like dictate that kind of, you know, the hours or even, you know, how long they should be on it during the day, given all the schoolwork that they kind of have to do.
I'm in the same boat with you, because I know, I mean, you look at the kid and they're like, oh my gosh, they can't avoid doing computer work. There's just no way. The way school is, the way their homework and everything demands are, they are going to be doing screen time. So what instead I usually say to patients and parents, and I'll say, if they can spend an hour or two in a sport, you know, after school every day, I don't, whatever sport they want to play, get them, or a hobby, something that is away from sitting at home, get them involved in some sort of after school activity. Ideally one that sometimes goes outside to try to help prevent some myopia progression too. But like, I think that's the best way to approach it. And then that kind of puts it back on, you know, where the parents trying to get me to tell them, take the cell phone away. Like, let's try to give them an alternative that's still engaging and interesting to them, that helps just with total body awareness and development, reduces childhood obesity. And I'll just straight up, what sports do you play? And then they'll tell me, oh, I do soccer, I do track, I do. I was like, that's great. You know, keep doing those things. You're doing a great job. I know sometimes you're going to want to use yourself into, but you're getting outdoors every single day. That's what I want to hear. And then on patients that they're not doing that, I'm like, we got to enroll you in some sort of activity or sport. See what you like, think about it, and then let's talk to mom about getting you signed up for some classes.
Parents, I usually just like lay out like the studies, and I tell them this one, like there's this study about pediatric dry eye. There's, you know, the vitamin D and, you know, progressive myopia. And like, I think parents don't know about these studies, but they just like feel that it's wrong that someone should stare at a screen for the amount of time that they do. So they like have this underlying feeling, like, it doesn't seem like something healthy that they should do, but maybe don't actually know that, yeah, this is like widely studied and the effects of this, you know, on, you know, in this case, pediatric dry eye. And so I really try to like teach the parents and tell them this sort of thing. And if, yeah, I totally agree with you, like sports, like, yeah, go outside. And I mean, all of this is like easier said than done, I guess. But yeah, I think education is like the biggest key in this whole thing.
Yeah, I agree with you ladies both. You know, I always just tell my patients straight up, look, we know there's been research correlating to dry eyes, to, you know, with the blue light from the screens messing with their circadian rhythm, to a long list of other things. So I'm like, hey, you know, let the kids go outside, play outside, relax, find a sport, do some type of activity. But we don't know what's going to happen to these eyes, you know, 10, 15 years down the road from all this technology. So you need to nip it in the bud right now, you know. And after that conversation, you know, the kids are looking at me like they hate me, and I'm just like, whatever, you know. But I think the tone that you actually use in the exam lane with the parent as well as with the kid and having direct eye-to-eye contact will help set that in stone, because I've had a few kids that come in the following year and they're like, yeah, I'm not using my cell phone as much. I'm actually picking up a book at night when I read. I'm blinking more, doing the 20/20/20 rule, you know, stuff of that nature for the most part. And I also think that maybe we should, as optometrists, maybe jump into the school system a little bit more and also tell them some of the issues that can take place with high computer time or cell phone time or whatever device they're using to get that education on. Maybe we should do more proactive engagement with the teachers as well.
That's a great point. Yeah.
I have seen, did you guys see, so obviously in Asia, myopia progression and dryness, obviously based on the study too, a huge issue with children there. Their indoor time spent is through the roof. They're in school like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. at night. There's no recess. Like, it is intense school structure there. And of course the myopia is through the roof. It's like 90 some percent of kids. And so they're looking at, well, they don't want to give up classroom time, but doing outdoor classrooms, like basically like a little greenhouse where it's all like window panels. So, cause they know sunlight based on these studies is supposed to help with myopia progression. But so in my head, I just keep thinking like, oh, our greenhouse classrooms of the future. But it might take a while. You know, we'd have to build all new schools.
It's a great idea. It sounds nice.
So hopefully, I'm sure we'll get some reporting on this in the next couple of years to see how these like experimental school situations were actually working. But other countries are taking this a little bit more aggressively because it's really making a huge impact on their overall health. I mean, as we know, myopia progression, it's not just like the boohoos of being a minus six, but they have higher incidences of glaucoma and retinal detachment, and it's just an unhealthier eye at a certain point. And then with dryness, again, it's not just like, oh, give them some tears. Like, that's a lifelong chronic issue that can interfere with their ability to do work. It can cause all sorts of structural permanent damages to the cornea and scarring. And so dryness as a kid, I mean, imagine dryness for that person at 50 when they're on the computer all day long and going through presbyopia. I don't want to be their doctor.
Now just look at all the other systemic conditions that could potentially go along with it. I mean, from just basic weight gain, from sitting in front of a terminal all day and not getting out, exercising, or, you know, just doing healthier things in general. And you tend to eat, you know, bad food during those situations as well. So it's very important to just push these kids to get outside. I mean, when I was younger, I used to go outside and play until the streetlight came on, you know, and now it's like, every kid that's born, they get an iPad as soon as they come out. You know, we have to stop that. It just doesn't make sense. It's just going to get worse. And Jen, touching on the greenhouse that you were mentioning earlier, that's very interesting. I don't know if you recall Dr. Bridget Shin Lee. She was telling us that, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity for those students in that part of the world. So they study all times of the day. So I don't even know if that would help, because the classroom setting is still going to be the same size and they're still going to spend numerous hours, whether it's there or at home, you know?
Yeah, I know. I mean, they're shooting at straws. Like, letting kids really play outside probably is the key. But I guess the hope is, like, because they could get sunlight in those classrooms, and then I guess maybe they'll have breaks where they let the kids look into the distance for
an interval. I mean, they're not going to look in the distance. They're going to look continually at those books. You know, it's crazy.
it's a tough world out there. And I think what we're all saying, it all starts too with the parents' lifestyle. I think that's why we give kids iPads and everything. Of course, we all enjoy iPads. I mean, I look at myself. I'm on mine as soon as I get home too. But it's easier for the parent to a certain extent to be like, oh, my kid's inside. I know where he's in his bedroom. I don't have to worry about anything happening to them. Outside playing in the street, like, you need to be out there and aware and like watching. And, you know, many parents will feel like a little bit more anxiety with that. So it's developed in this way because it's also something that parents are doing and parents feel comfortable with. They're on their iPhone, they're on the thing. So it all starts with like trying to change how the parent's life is set up too. If your kid sees you on your cell phone all day, why would they do any different?
Yeah, you have to lead by examples, no doubt about it. I mean, I wish I could just take all my patients that come in, their parents, the kid, and just say, look, you're the parent. Tell them to put the iPad down. I mean, that's just it. It's not hard. You know, it's not rocket science. Just tell them you're the adult. Don't let them run you. You know, take it away. Or tell them you have X amount of time from when you get out of school, maybe an hour to play around, but do your homework on it and go from there. I mean, it's really not that hard. It's just, like I said before, you know, the kids that are coming up now, they're born with an iPad or iPhone in their hand as soon as they come out. So it's just one of those tough situations. I will make sure that my kid does not come out with an iPad or or iPhone or whatever when they come out.
You know, I'm going to call you out so hard when your baby in 2 years has an iPad.
Yeah. So, you know, speaking of iPads and kids and, you know, moving from dry eye to, you know, more like blue light. Do you ladies ever recommend just, you know, like blue light glasses to kids at all when you're in the exam room? Like, how does that, I know you do. How does the conversation take place? Because, I mean, again, that's a great opportunity to keep your patients loyal to the practice by educating about dryness, educating about blue light. But how does that conversation take place?
I might be a little bit more controversial, so.
Okay, let's hear it.
So I am really big into myopia control, and I had gone a couple of years ago to the Vision by Design conference, and there were some really interesting presentations there about the importance of blue light in slowing down myopia progression. Okay, it's apparently in the photoreceptors that are responsible primarily for blue light detection are some of our more like reptilian brain cells, and those cells need stimulation to a certain extent. So we don't want to totally block all blue light. Now, do I believe in UV protection? Absolutely. I don't want sunburns on my kids, but I don't prescribe Provincia all that much for children. And instead I'll prescribe Transitions that has some blue block in it, and then also tell them to go outside more because I want them to get that sunlight exposure. And sunlight has, you know, when you compare a computer to the sun, sun has way more blue light than the computer does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think a lot of people forget that.
I'm kind of with, I don't really talk a lot about blue light protection. I don't know, in my like everyday sort of practicing, I say you shouldn't be on your phone, and that solves the problem. But no, I'm just kidding. That doesn't. I just like find that I just like don't, I don't know. I just don't talk about it as much. And I do have patients ask me about it. But it hasn't, I don't know. I need to talk to Jen more about this, or, and you, Daryl, too, because I think, do you do that? I mean, do you talk about that with your patients?
Absolutely. I mean, the area when I'm in the States and practicing, I'm in the area where it's something known as the Research Triangle Park, and it's a lot of folks that are into IT or also just in that area in general. There's a lot of schools, medical schools, law schools and stuff like that. So it's a lot of people that spend a lot of time in front of the computer. So I'm always educating them about blue light, telling them about, you know, the negativities of it. And like Jennifer said, Transitions, adaptive lens technology is one of my go-tos. The Provincia I like to use as well. But for me, I typically just prescribe her lifestyle. And in that area, again, it's just a lot of lifestyle that revolves around high computer demand.
I think that's, I'll talk blue light because, again, we have a ton of people in this area that are on the computer all day long. Mm-hmm. Tired eyes. My patients are telling like, oh, my God, so much bags under my eyes. My eyes are so tired. And then I'll talk about how blue light has been shown to be more fatiguing. And we'll talk about turning, you know, night mode on their iPads or phones or using Flux on their computer screens. And then we'll talk about like Provincia, for example, for that. But I prescribe it as fatigue reducing more so than I do eye help, which I know, I mean, there are studies that say maybe it could be a risk for macular health. But the way that study was set up, I don't think it's enough for me to be like, oh, you'll get macular degeneration if you don't have these glasses. So yeah, I talk about it a lot more as like, oh, your eyes are tired. Well, let's get you're on the computer all day. Let's try to dial back some of those like harsher blue lights your eyes are having to look at.
And another good way is to actually just have your patient sit in front of the computer and just hold a loose lens in front of them, whether it's a plus a quarter, plus 50, plus 75. And most trial lens sets actually have anti-reflective coating on the lens. And the first thing they'll say is, oh, wow, this is more HD flavor. I feel like there's less glare or something like that. So actually showing them the difference makes a world of difference, and them educating themselves and seeing it firsthand as well.
Yeah. There was a study that came out recently where they were polling average patients, and you know, in optometry, blue light is a huge buzzword, and everyone's talking about it. Patients do not know what the heck that is, so they have like no awareness of blue light. It just doesn't sound all that dangerous, you know. So I don't think it's as a term that's actually ever going to fully cross over into like the public's awareness of how they need to have blue light protection. But I do think a lot of people that are on the computer all day long, they are super familiar with gunner lenses. And that's the whole idea, I mean, really, behind what a gunner lens is. It's yellow, so of course it's going to block blues like crazy. So I kind of go about it at that approach. Like, this is a tint or a filter I can put on your glasses to make them less tiring. And that kind of science, I think, does cross over well. I talk a lot about tired eyes.
Yeah, and it works well with millennials as well. I mean, you'll notice a lot of them coming in and they'll know about the different apps to reduce the blue light, or a lot of folks will come in and they'll tell me after we've had the conversation the previous year, hey, did you know the iPhone now has this button you can press and it reduces the blue light? And I mean, if you're looking at your cell phone around, like myself, I wake up early, 4 or 5 in the morning, and you hit that switch, I mean, it's truly night and day. And I have a lot of patients coming in telling me about that as well. I think it's the demographic and where you're at for folks that are actually exposed to it or not, or to the terminology, I should say, as Jen was saying earlier.
Yeah, I think that people are becoming more aware of it, because like even when I'm like scrolling through my Facebook, there's like I have all these ads for like these blue light filtering glasses or anti-fatigue glasses, like new startups that are, you know, Warby Parker-esque that have, you know, new glasses out. So I think, and then like there was an article in the New York Times about it, and this guy wore these glasses. They, you know, they were yellow glasses and he felt like they really helped. So I think it's like it's slowly like getting out there, at least with the millennial generation too, yeah. For the people that are always on their, you know, a phone or looking at a screen or something.
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing that is a plus for us is the millennial generation, they do have a lot of eye complaints. My goodness. Their eye world is a problem.
That's another statement.
And they have a lot of ocular aesthetic complaints, which is something that we are specifically skilled at trying to help. So their eyes are always red. Their under eyes are always purple. You know, like this is stuff that they want to fix. And nothing fixes a purple under eye like a yellow tinted glass. it's like concealer. So there's hidden beauty aspects of it.
So Jen, are you, I know the Transitions Extra Active is not a yellow, you know, tint to it, but it has, you know, mine, I have the brown color and it has that little brown visitant. Are you using that for,
I don't really like, unless someone straight up says I want yellow glasses, like I don't prescribe that. Most people don't want that, but Extra Active is my go-to because it does have that slight brown tint, even when it's clear. Yeah. It's ever so slightly tinted. It makes, like, people would ask me, like, oh, did you do your makeup different or something? And I was like, nope, just have my glasses makeup on. So Extra Active Brown, that is a great tint if you want to look fresher, if you will. Provincia, it makes you look kind of purpley behind the glasses. So for a woman, I mean, I'll get complaints. I'm a little hesitant. I make sure they see what Provincia looks like before I get them to put it in their glasses, because it can make your under eye circles look a little bit worse. So that's just a little bit of a heads up to female prescribing.
Sounds like a lot of ladies' problems there. You know, this guy like, put some glasses on me, let me keep it going. You know, just make sure I look good. Make sure my wife is smiling when she sees my face, you know?
Nobody needs purple undertones on their skin, Daryl.
Oh, the woes of women. Preeclampsia, under eye circles.
I know. It's a hard life for us. But that's why women doctors have better outcomes, right, Dr. Garlitch? That's what they're more sensitive to the needs, the entire needs. Daryl's putting these purple glasses on those patients. They're going to look around like they have black eyes.
Oh my! I said it a few podcasts ago. The ladies are truly taking over. There's no doubt about it. But hey,
you're out now.
I love women. I'm all about it. I don't mind it at all. It's a beautiful thing.
Thank you guys so much. We had a lot of fun. This is probably the most fun conversation I've ever had about studies. So.
Yeah, right?
That's good, yeah.
Hey, maybe we might make it a monthly thing or a quarterly thing. We'll bring Jackie back and recap on
something. Sure, I'd love to. It sounds great. Yeah, studies can't, like, they kind of, sometimes it can be written boring, but sometimes we can make them fun.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. You always make it fun. Whenever I get that email, I open it up and I devote, you know, a good 20, 30 minutes to it because I know it's going to be entertaining, you know?
Well, you guys,
I like the way you convey your message.
That's right. Please leave your comments if you guys have any questions for Dr. Garlich, and if you want to subscribe to her weekly newsletter. It's fun, just like this podcast was. She breaks through the studies and the latest tech and trends in eye care with short, sweet, fun little paragraphs. Not even paragraphs, just a couple of sentences, really. It's, if I had written even paragraphs, that's why I'm not fun. But, check it out at 2020 Glance.
Thanks, guys, for having me. This was fun.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast. And remember, we keep it 2020 around here. Pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.